Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eye of the Truth. With us is Glenn Deason, Professor Deason, who I don't think needs an introduction by this point. I don't think. Maybe it's somebody who's been hiding under a rock somewhere. he's a professor in Norway, and he used to be a professor here in Moscow. Maybe back again sometime soon, depending on, I guess, which way Europe, the rest of Europe goes. Luckily, Norway is not part of the EU, so it's not under the van der Leyen dictatorship, or is it still? How much does Norway follow Brussels dictates?
Well, if you well, first let me thank you for that kind introduction. But yeah, if you well, the EU is interesting because if you're smaller countries who are a bit wealthy, like Switzerland or Norway, they want to sit this one out because well, with the option of joining later, if it would work, which it isn't. But they're often put on what's called a pay without a say program, which means they still have to some different ways pump money in. They also have to ad adopt a lot of the same legislation, but not really without a with a voice. But they wouldn't have much of a voice anyways because of the small population. So, but in the bigger picture, they toe the line and do the same as the EU. So it's a bit of a split you see with many countries. That is, the political elites would like to join these international institutions, while the public is a bit more cautious. So the political elites and the journalists, they are very excited about the possibility of joining the EU, but they can't really get the public with them. It's a bit like what happened with the Swedes and the Finns with NATO. The public was always opposed to it. The military and the political establishment were in favor. And then when Russia went into Ukraine, the polls went up in terms of wanting to join NATO because of the shock, and then they saw an opportunity and they rushed it through quickly. So it's it feels like that could happen with the EU in this country as well.
Oh, that's sad though. I remember when the American, I'm sorry, the Ukrainians, I'm sorry, Gilligan and Skipper were on a boat and blew up the Nord Stream accidentally. I mean, why not at this point? People seem to be ready to believe anything. When the Americans blew up Nord Stream, and Norway, of course, was just opened up its pipeline. And profits start rolling in, and in the EU, everybody starts screaming, "Well, I think Norway needs to give back some to an organization it's not a part of, that it's a provider of gas to. So, why don't you ask the Americans to give back some while you're at it? I mean, that'll fly over like a brick."
Yeah, I wasn't certain about the date, but after Nord Stream blew up, I think that the pipeline going from Norway down to Poland, it opened the very next day, which
Yeah, it
was
did. Yeah,
well,
coordinate.
it doesn't look good. But no, the country has made a lot of money from gas sales because well, Russia used to be the main competitor, and then it was well, the Europeans liberated themselves from the energy, it's a bit like liberating yourself from oxygen. It does make much sense, but this is part of the problem. They call this energy security, but of course, energy security entails a reliable supply of cheap energy. And the path to energy security is you want diversification. You want many suppliers. In the EU, they said, "Well, Russia's a bad supplier. America's a good supplier. So let's just cut off one and develop excessive dependence on the other." But that's then you won't get cheap energy because there's only one supplier and it won't be reliable. So, but again, tell this to a leadership which has become so ideological, and the hatred of Russia really goes down to their core. So it's very difficult to get any common sense. But anyways, my point was the Norwegians made a lot of money because the gas sales are quite profound, especially to the British and the Germans. So the rhetoric then was, well, we're making so much money, it's not it's unjust, so we have to give back. But that means to pump a lot of weapons and money into Ukraine, which then ensures the further devastation of Ukraine, as opposed to if someone would actually picked up a phone and tried to call Moscow. So it's very strange logic. First, make a lot of money off this war, and then use that proceeds to fund the war further, and then this will kind of be the that makes everything moral somehow. It's a if you would have open discussions and debates around this, it would make much sense. But as often happens in wars, there won't be much debates anymore. Everyone
No,
has to toe the
no.
line.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, in Russia, we see a lot here in the media about what the Europeans are saying. But of course, like any other country, especially with a party to any kind of conflict, you're going to get a bit of yellow journalism. Or in America, you get nothing but yellow journalism. So, just the quantity that's mixed in there. What are you seeing as far as the Europeans? Look, they've, I mean, they the Baltic states, they cut off Russian electricity. Now their electricity is four times more expensive because they're paying spot rates from Finland, from Germany, and from no, from Finland, Sweden, and Poland. Europe has cut off Russian gas. Norway can't feed Europe to the full extent. U.S. physically can't feed Europe to the full extent because it would have to take gas off of its own market, and that will go over really well with the voting public. Qatar is out. Qatar is out, and possibly out for a very long time. But in fact, yesterday they got hit again on their LNG plant. So it's not just a shutdown. It's not just a month or 3 weeks to put it back up, but they have to repair it too. What are you hearing in Europe as far as gas crisis? Because I mean, this really is a gas crisis. They just lost, and Moscow is turning its back on LNG as well. I mean, they're still going to supply. They said flat out, we're not going to forget our friends, Hungary, Slovakia. So some of it will get past Hungary, Slovakia. Because Hungary, Slovakia is going to make a good chunk of money off of reselling it, but basically, they're still going to lose a very large chunk of it because the LNG market will be out. There's plenty of other people that will buy Russian LNG now, since Qatar LNG is gone. What are you seeing in Europe? What are they saying?
Well, as I said, after liberating themselves from Russian energy, they've now been involuntarily liberated from Middle Eastern energy as well. So this is a problem. Of course, the U.S.-Israeli strike on the South Pars in Iran, this also will create a shock. This is the world's largest gas field. And of course, the Iranians and are now retaliating predictably, as one would expect. And we see the hits against Qatari LNG and against Saudi oil, not just the refineries, but also the ports, especially in Saudi Arabia, because they also have ports on the western coast on the Red Sea. So if they can shut this down, then they can further create these economic problems for the United States. And this is how they have to fight. Anyways, the problem now is that the energy problems of Europe becomes even worse, and at some point, ideology can just, keep it going so long. You have to recognize reality at some point. So now, of course, there has to be some way of trying to perhaps bring get some Russian energy after all. Not for the von der Leyen's. They will go down to the bunker at the end. There will be no change of the hearts there. But you see in other parts, there are some changing rhetoric. For example, the Belgium Prime Minister, he came out and he said that at some point we have to start now talking about restoring diplomacy with Russia. And he also made the point thereafter that it's quite strange that the Europeans are financing the war, yet they don't have any seat at the table to negotiate. I would add that this was by design, by the way. This
Oh,
is
yeah,
they did this on
absolutely.
purpose. They shut down the diplomacy in early 2022, made sure the Ukrainians did the same. They declared that weapons are the path to peace. This will be resolved on the battlefield, and they just started pumping weapons in. What's interesting at the, in the, on those days, the only one who tried to still keep some diplomacy with Putin was Macron, and he actually gave an interview in 2022 and made a point that. Maybe we should keep talking with the Russians because if we don't, the future of Europe would be negotiated by Washington and Moscow, not by us, which was very, very true. And of
Yep.
course, he fell in line as everyone was sold the idea that it's immoral to talk to Russia. That was a reward because nothing pleases Putin more than the phone calls and meeting with Europeans. This is the source of his legitimacy. Yeah. Well, this is how
Macron.
often they think that diplomacy is not to find compromise and mutual understanding. It's something that defers legitimacy upon others. So we deny them this legitimacy, and this is kind of a pressure tactics. But anyway, it's not just the Belgians. Now you see Macron, trying to also reach out at least halfway. He wanted to join in on the trilateral Ukraine, Russia, US negotiations, but given that the Europeans have played the role of a spoiler, the Russians told him more or less, well, pardon the language, but to fuck off. And
They told him exactly to fuck off. Ushakov told him, "Иди нахуй," which actually means "go to the dick," which I think is literally even worse than just to say "fuck
yeah,
off."
they either
Yeah,
Nahoy, that's an interesting swear.
yeah, "Иди нахуй." So yeah, that's pardon the French, ladies and gentlemen, but this is we're just quoting exactly what various very high placed people are saying. How did they react to that? I mean, in France, have you heard anything back or any kind of ripples? Because that's pretty much so, that's worse than the Iranians telling you we're not interested in negotiations. This is to the Americans, nice and calm, and this is, you know, this is straightforward.
Yeah, but whether we talk about the proxy war against Russia, the war against Iran, or the economic sanctions, the boycotting of diplomacy, all of this is premised on the illusion or the delusion of escalation dominance, that one can choose when, for example, war starts, how they're fought, how they should end. But also in the diplomatic sphere, it means, we will decide when the Russians will be, let in back from the cold, when we'll start to talk to them again. And also, yes, now we actually need some gas now, so now you'll be allowed to sell to us. So yeah, this is kind of the thinking, and this is part of the curse of the unipolar moment, or even the decades even before that, that there was one center of economic power, which was the political West. If you wanted to thrive, you had to find a way of making a deal. So the idea is, if the political West can stand united, then the whole rest of the world would have to fall in line. It's a very different world that is emerging now. So the
Right.
idea that they now pick up the phone, okay, Putin, we're ready to talk to you. Here are our conditions, and also we are considering letting you sell us gas. It's very strange to get the comment back going, no, well, we're not really interested. We had the same experience with the Chinese. That is, they put sanctions on the Chinese, and then the Chinese respond with the same economic coercion, and then there's some moral indignation there, like they're outraged. Well, how could they? You can't do that against us. It's their sole prerogative of the political West, because when we do economic coercion, we usually do it from a high position of moral authority. It's rooted in democracy, human rights. This is why it's only our legitimate instrument, not
Right.
yours. So it's the same with Iranians. Okay, we're considering stopping the war temporarily, maybe a ceasefire. At least we have to regroup, send some more weapons, and the hope is that they will come crawling. And yes, oh, thank you. But instead they say, or as a finance minister, sorry, a foreign minister said very clearly, we're not interested in a ceasefire. We want a political settlement, which is almost a copy paste of what the Russians are saying. So it is a different world, which is difficult for them to adjust to, that they don't get to dictate when to engage in diplomacy, the condition of it, or how to end the war, how it should be fought. It's a very different world. It takes some getting used to, I think, because we have a whole political class now raised over the past 35 years of this exceptionalism. There was one central power, and they're force for good, and they will shape the world in their image, and the rest of the world should be grateful. So it's it will take time, I think. This, I mean, you see the same. Your former American army officer, you read the papers, the way people think, it's very detached from
Oh
how
yeah,
reality has developed.
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it's the interesting thing is from the Iranians is they've actually upped the ante from what Russia wants. They've said, oh, and reparations. I'm pretty sure the average American Congress critter would rather eat his own liver than vote for reparations for Iran. So they're at an impasse. What do you do now? Reparations is not something that Americans would even think to look at. America pay reparations to somebody? That's unheard of.
Oh, no, it's not gonna. No. Well, the Americans wouldn't do that, and also Trump, he needs something that he can sell as a victory at home, even if it's very superficial. But once you pay reparation, then that's what the loser do. You can't get around it. But the Iranians can find a way of doing this. I mean, there's been some comments coming, I think, was from the foreign minister that there's no going back to the way things were in terms of the Strait of Hormuz. And I think that they will tell, it was a good chance that one of the possibilities, they tell the Gulf states, listen, you're the one not just encouraging this, but you supported the attack. You provided your territory, airspace to back an American attack on us. Now it's reparation time. If you want to use the Strait of Hormuz, we will tax you. You don't have to pay all their reparation at once, but from now on, every ship passing through here will more or less, you will pay us, 50 million or 100. I don't know how this works, but you will pay us a certain amount every week or every month. And if you don't, then there's no more getting through here, and your nations are over. And I think that is one of many possibilities. But of course, it could happen they don't get the reparations. But the whole idea that the Iranians are putting forward demands for the United States for how the war should end, this goes against past decades. That is, we decide when the war starts, how it starts, who should participate, how it should be fought. We control most of the variables, and of course, finally, we'll decide when we can put an end to it, if it's going to be temporary or permanent. All of this is now slipping out of control. And I always made a point, this is the same mistake being done with the Russian, the assumption that we can just escalate, we'll throw in some missiles into Moscow, some drones, and then, okay, if we need to scale it back again, we can scale it back, de-escalate. But we're seeing now it's not working. And there's desperate efforts. Just as a last comment on that, you saw Trump after they attacked the South Pars. He said, "Oh, it wasn't us; it was the Israelis." But we're not going to have an energy war. There won't be more of this unless Iran does something else. Then we'll burn everything down. So, but this is what you say if you want to. You want to attack, you escalate. They do the same with the Russians, and then they tell, "Listen, okay, we're not behind it." And if you retaliate, then we're going to go further up the escalation ladder. As long as you don't retaliate, we'll go up, maybe then we'll go down. But essentially, they will control it. And what the Iranians said, which perhaps the Russians should have done as well, was just say, well, you don't control the escalation ladder. You attacked us. Now we're going to burn down all of these refineries. Because Trump's words doesn't mean anything. It just means that he wants to tell the Iranians how they're allowed to retaliate. And once Iran accepts that premise, then it's game over for the Iranians. And so they rejected it.
Yeah, there's another thing. They've hit Iranian industry, and they've already said, the Iranians said, they gave well, they didn't give an ultimatum. They gave a time frame for all American companies to get their people out, because we're just going to wipe out every single one of your manufacturing plants up and down the Middle East. We'll target the manufacturing plants that are American owned. And Aramco itself is about half American owned. So that's a big hit on U.S. Shareholders when Aramco infrastructure goes up in flames. And that's long term. I mean, you take out one of these big facilities, if you do serious damage to it, you're looking at years of repairs, tear down repairs. It's not something that, oh, okay, put some Scotch tape on it, and then we'll start pumping oil again. No. So yeah, that's a very good point. Well, you heard about the video from Trump where he's moaning it's unfair that the Iranians have they've lost, we've won, and but they've closed down the Straits of Hormuz. That's a little bit unfair. It's an interesting approach.
No, but this goes into the whole idea. We will win, and we get to decide what the victory looks like. So, but he already declared victory, but the Iranians haven't capitulated. Instead, they're blocking the Strait of Hormuz. They're not following the script. But that's the whole point. There is no escalation control anymore.
No, there
And
isn't.
if Iran wants a proper deterrent to make sure the Americans never do this again, that's the most important thing they can do, because any restraint and predictability, it would be interpreted as weakness. Because, I mean, and the Americans know this, especially Trump knows this, because he's playing this card himself. I'm pretty sure that he's inspired by Nixon's madman theory, in which you just present yourself deliberately a little bit more irrational than you are, so your adversaries won't poke too much. If you do a little poke against Americans, you don't know if they will just go fully nuclear. So you're very cautious when you engage with them. This is what countries like North Korea have to do? I mean, if they act completely rational and predictable, then Americans think, okay, we can just bomb, drop three bombs on their capital today and warn them, if you retaliate, then we'll wipe out their whole capital, and then they will make the rational decision to let it go. Well, now their deterrence is gone, and you can just escalate and de-escalate as you want, and bomb them on will. So there's always an interest to show, to restore deterrence. Just if anyone bombs, even one bomb, just burn down everything around you. If this is what your adversaries think you will do, and credibly so, then they will probably never attack you. So restraint is interpreted as a weakness, and that's very unfortunate because, ideally we want restraint in the international system for stability.
Absolutely. Well, here's a question. Are the Europeans considering, and there's a lot of questions, obviously, but because there's a lot of issues that raised up this, but are the Europeans even a little bit concerned that what Iran has done to U.S. bases? There's a lot of pressure from the military in Russia, from other politicians, hardline politicians. I'll admit it, I'm saying it myself. This is what Russia should be doing, and I've been saying this, you hit NATO once or twice. They'll go back and step back over the line. They're not going to start a world war, not at least not right now. They're incapable of it. But it's deterrence. You're right. Russia has lost that deterrence, or the concept of deterrence from the European side. Are they any bit afraid that with Iran showing what it can do, 23 American bases, I mean, it's demobilizing one drone at a time, one ballistic missile at a time, 23 American bases. That Russia may, the government will finally get forced or feel strong enough to do the same thing to the NATO powers that have been sending drones into Russia through their territories, like the Baltic states, and other things of that nature. Oh, seem they're frozen up. Two. And we're
Well,
back.
I think the Europeans haven't really taken that lesson yet, or seen that the Russians might be taking a page out of the book of the Iranians. That what has bothered the Russians the most, which is a greatest concern, is that they let their deterrence slip. That is, that
Yes.
the Europeans no longer seem to fear Russia. That is the logic we often see in the media as well. We stepped over all the red lines, and they didn't do anything. So what's going to happen this time? So the warmongers always win the argument with this. So you would think that after what happened in Iran, and how the Russians are now responding to it, thinking, yeah, well, perhaps we should do this, that this would enter the discussion in Europe. But I think the Europeans have been, trapped by narratives. This is something that also a guest of mine often says, that is the former the CIA director for Russia analysis, George Beebe, also makes this point that the Europeans trapped themselves in this narratives that, they're not actually fighting, helping Ukraine defend itself. So it's important to hold on to these narratives, but that's also all the unification in the EU. There is based on no dissent, because if you have 27 countries agreeing on the foreign policy, you need very powerful narratives and shame opposition. Otherwise, the 27 countries will go in different directions. So they all kind of bought into this idea that they're not actually fighting Russia; they're just helping Ukraine. So it sounds absurd, but this is what all the politicians and all the media are kind of repeating. Anyways, I you would think that at some point we would wake up to see how the new distribution of power affects alliance systems, because again, the Europeans are frontline states for the US.
Right.
But in the 1990s, when the US was the most dominant power, there was no rival, then this was okay. It was if you wanted security, then you aligned yourself with the US. It monopolized on security. That's how a unipolar world works, with one hegemon. And that was, again, in the 90s, the logic of NATO. If you want security in Europe, you join NATO. If you're left outside, then you're on your own, and there are no alternatives. And the OSCE, UN, all of these things, they pale in comparison, because the power is with the US, and the US elevated NATO. So you would think then that they would begin to worry how the US will behave now that
Right.
it's a declining empire. And what happens then? Well, you see this in the Middle East. All of its frontline states are now getting burned down literally to the ground. And how about East Asia? It also has frontline states there, but it had to pull out all the air defenses from South Korea and send them down to fight Iran. Even within the Middle East, the air defenses coming down, they're not going to the Arab states, Israel first, of course. So one has to ask oneself, what happens now? Well, what about Europe? The Americans show that they're willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. All the Europeans are showing the same, but the Europeans still think that they have a seat at the table, that there's a political West, that we're in the same club as the United States. So we are fighting to the last Ukrainian. They don't seem to accept that they're no longer the subject, but the object. That is, the US could also fight to the last European. And
Absolutely.
again, this is why the West, there is no one West. It's the US, and then there's others. And they haven't really accepted this yet, because their whole worldview has been built up on the idea that we're part of the West. If the West is gone, we're just a bunch of Europeans who severed our connectivity with key centers of power and are now in a position to be, exploited by the US. So no, they should worry about this, because Russia now has very strong incentives to restore its deterrent. And there's one way of doing it, and that's the Iranian way. And I think, we're heading in that direction. And but if you're gonna even have a discussion about this, you have to accept that we are fighting, that we, that is the NATO countries, are fighting against Russia. But there's no willingness to even accept this premise. It's just Russia want to take over Ukraine, and we're helping Ukraine defend itself. And that's the only narrative that's acceptable, unless you're Putin puppet who's repeating Kremlin talking points. So this is we locked ourselves really hard into this. So there's no course correction. There's no reality. Can't enter. He can't beat the narrative. So it's a very difficult position that the Europeans are in.
Yeah, if you look at world history, realistically speaking, big battles were the exception. Because most generals and most empires, they didn't want a big battle because they knew on a big battle, you could lose your entire country. And if we look at Iran as a big battle, the decline in the U.S. may be very quick after this. Internal rifts, especially if they do boots on the ground, and it looks like they're going for boots on the ground, as insane as that is. And the U.S. does not have nearly enough military to try to do boots on the ground. And it's not going to be Vietnam. It's going to be Korea, with lines of contact and mountain fighting. They're insane, desperate, insane. But for Europeans, here's another. This is going to be a little bit right field, but or left field, whichever you want to look at it, or far out field. Now, having said all that and seeing that the empire is in decline, obvious decline, and aircraft carriers are what everybody who's had any concept has been saying for 20 years, they're outdated. But now they're obviously outdated because they're not in the fight. They're staying as far away as possible. In all of this, the U.S., well, particularly Europeans, have cre helped create a Frankenstein monster called Zelensky and the Ukrainian mafia. Which Zelensky is maybe a face of, but there's a lot of it that's flowing into Europe. Now you've got this tin pod dictator with actually pretty relatively large army, who is now threatening not just the life of the head of state of a European Union country, but his minions are now threatening to kill his children and his friends. I mean, directly, we know where you live, we know what restaurants you go to, and so on and so on. How could any European leader tolerate that? Knowing that, tomorrow you may have not given enough or kissed Zelensky's arse off, and now you're on the list of his naughty list. I'm going to go after your family. Can Europe tolerate that next door?
Well, we go back to the same problem. What is Europe? Is this 27 countries? How do you get all 27 countries with different interests, different security interests, different economic interests to march in line? Well, everything has to be simplified into black and white stories. So, what is the narrative everyone has to buy into? Well, Orbán is a right-wing populist. He's also Putin's best friend in Europe. He's like our Trojan horse. He's an ally of Putin. The Hungarians can, until they're blue in the face, point out, no, we're not putting Russia first, we're putting Hungary first. But it's in Hungary's national interest to have good working relations with Russia. It's not in our interest to partake in this war. It's not even in Ukraine's interest to participate in this war. So, but all the Europeans are hearing is, well, you're not participating in the war against Russia, so then you're with Putin. So it's either or. Either you support this policy or you're with Putin. And if you're with Putin, then you're the embodiment of evil in the eyes of these people. So there's very little sympathy. So they're not going to stand up for their own guy. They're going to stand up for Zelensky and point out that Orban is being unfair. So the fact that Zelensky can sit there, threaten the life of Orban, and there's just cricket noises, nothing coming from the EU. It's on one hand it's shocking, but on the other hand, this is I wouldn't expect anything else. When that happened, did anyone think that the EU leaders would stand up and stand in solidarity? No, of course not. It's a bit similar to when Chancellor Merz was sitting next to Trump, and Trump he was trying to essentially be the number one front man of the Europeans, in the alliance against Iran, saying, we stand fully by with you. Yes, we support you, but can you also help us with Ukraine? So, it was very obvious what he was doing. Like we were going to show our obedience, and then perhaps you can throw us a bone. And but then Trump went on the rant, blasting the Spanish, saying that we're going to put, break our economic ties, and you have Merz sitting there, saying nothing, not a peep. Just so there is no European solidarity. It's just what the EU wants. You can either fall in line or, or we ignore you. I don't see the solidarity they're talking about. If you deviate from the policies, then it's not that we have different perspectives or interests. It's that it's immoral, and Orban has been immoral, and so they're not going to support him. If I can look quickly on the Iranian thing, I just want to say I think you're spot on. That is, the U.S. strategy is not. I don't think ideally it would be a huge war. I think ideally they want to kill Iran with many small cuts. That is, you cripple it with sanctions over the decades. You instigate some civil unrest. You finance some terror groups. Maybe you can destabilize it with some proxies from Syria. You can, cut it off from its key allies. You can try to force it to abandon its civilian nuclear power to further hurt the economy. You can bomb them a bit in June to create the distrust and unfavorable conditions for the market, anger with the government. If that doesn't work, you can bomb them a little bit again. But this is how you gradually wear it down. The Iranians know this. They know they're being killed with a
Oh, yeah.
thousand cuts. So that's why they're going all in here. And now they're saying, no more. Either we find a political settlement and you put an end to this nonsense, or we just continue and drain you of your resources. It's a big gamble, but doing nothing, accepting these small cuts, that's also suicidal for the Iranians. So they've been put in a very difficult position.
And that's, by the way, the arguments that are done by the more conservative side in Russian politics. Like, well, they're doing the same thing to us. Send 91 drones against Vladimir Vladimirovich's residency. Throw in a few Flamingo drones, missiles deep in. Do this, do that. Assassinate a general. But that's death by a thousand cuts. And every time, oh, it's only the Ukrainians. Beat them. Don't beat us. They're the ones that are at fault. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think the Iranian response is absolutely the proper response. You don't wait for the enemy to keep bleeding you. You just it's death either way. So might as well take it, with a shield and a sword in your hand and go and do the max amount of damage and maybe win, rather than just sit there and wait till they bleed you and you just collapse. Which is bad for the Americans, obviously. They weren't expecting it. They really weren't. That's become obvious.
But if you want to destroy the deterrence of another country, there's one good way of doing it. That is the salami tactics or incrementalism. You do small things, because if you do a big thing, like imagine in 2022, the NATO countries would have just started this immediately, send in the storm shadows and just start
Right.
launching missiles into Russian cities. The Russians would have hit back in a massive way. Berlin might be just a smoking hole in the ground, but you don't do this. You do the incrementalism, and NATO has actually been quite good at this. Do small steps. And then, okay, we expand a little bit, NATO, for example, but we'll give you the NATO-Russia Founding Act, where we put limits, we're not going to put bases, and then slowly, okay, well, we're not actually going to follow this. Same with missile defense. Condoleezza Rice began saying, listen, we're just going to have 10 interceptors. The Russians are really paranoid. If they respond to this in some way, that just shows that they're paranoid. Well, those 10 becomes hundreds, those hundreds becomes thousands. And it's the same now. With this war, you go slow steps, and then it becomes each step of the way, the Russians will then think, well, if we retaliate against this, it seems a bit over the top. It was just one general killed, it was just one assassination, just one bomb, just a few storm shadows. But if you take a stop and then look back and see how far this has moved, what's happening now? You have American contractors and British launching their own weapons, guided by their own satellites, hitting targets deep inside Russia, which has been picked by their intelligence, which is all organized under their war planners. I mean, what are the Ukrainians doing now? They don't have almost no role in this. They can,
Well,
it's
they're
uh,
bleeding on the battlefield, but that's it.
yes, no, that well, they're being used as well. So no, I think it's the incrementalism that is the dangerous part, and I think that's what Iranians are also defending themselves from.
Well, that's predicated on the fact, well, not a fact, on the theory that the other side will just continue stepping back without the spring of, effect. Because what's happening in Russian, particularly Russian military and Russian conservative society, is that anger, that spring is getting tight, and what the non-incremental counter-escalatory move is going to be hard to say. And and I've said it. Hit the if you hit the NATO bases, I mean, I'm not a pinprick hit, but a wipeout. Let the Estonians, for example, strike at some Russian tanker, and then respond, overwhelmingly respond, so that there's no questions left that this is it. That will reset the point quite a bit. But it can't be incremental back. It has to be one big leap that makes everybody scared again. But if it hadn't been this incrementalism, we wouldn't have to have a big leap forward. And I think the big leap forward now, if you wipe out, for example, the Polish base on the Ukrainian side, I mean, wipe it out, not hit it a few times. There has to be nothing left of it. Burn it to the ground. Then everybody will reset. Everybody will get scared, and maybe they'll remember MAD and everything else. If you don't, then the next step may be a nuclear weapon, because it'll go that far that it's the survival of the country. And then the saying, better to sacrifice 1,000 than 1,000,000, than 1,000,000 later. I mean, Ukraine's a prime example of that. If Yanukovych had taken out those demonstrators, well, the demonstrators of those armed thugs early on, millions of people would be alive right now.
Well, that's another risk, though, with or a purpose for function of the incrementalism or the salami tactics. That is, if the adversary at some point actually responds, that can be seen as being an overreaction, because they're seen to only respond to this little new step we took. We just took a little slice and look at this massive response. Well, to use the NATO language, it's unprovoked, we would say. And that is, of course, the key narrative of this war as well. That is that the response was unprovoked. It was not proportional. It was excessive. But of course, one goes and look what happened just now, the last few weeks. But again, if you looked at when the Russians invaded Ukraine, they don't mention going back to 2014, the coup, the hijacking the Ukrainian intelligence services, the CIA bases along the Russian borders, the incursions by these intelligence operations into Russian territory, the death of Russian soldiers, the hijacking of the Ukrainian government, of civil society, their media, the training and arming of these far-right groups, which were killing people in Donbas for years and years. The Ukrainians who voted in 2019 on a peace mandate, who then had it canceled by the Western NGOs and the far-right armed groups, which also threatened Zelensky, the
Right.
sabotage of Minsk over all these years. Like, none of this is here. Like, these are the gradual steps that were taking place, and instead one just looks, well, what happened now? We didn't do anything. It just came out of nowhere. So this is the incrementalism. It has a purpose, and it's that was the point of missile defense as well.
Yep.
Actually, I forgot his name. He was with in the Trump administration. He called what the, he had a word for it. He called it I forgot the name. Anyway, so the whole point behind the missile defense was, instead of planning a big missile defense right here and it comes out and it the Europeans go a bit cautious because they're afraid of what kind of reaction will this cause from the Russians? How would the Russians respond? He says the best thing is just to start small, and then you just build it
Right.
gradually up. And then it doesn't cause any ripple effects. The Europeans slowly, like a boiling frog, would get used to
Exactly,
this idea,
exactly.
and the Russians would, it's just another one this month, another one next month, and there's nothing real to react to. So this is it's a common strategy, and as you said, the problem is, for if you listen to Putin's 2014 the Crimean speech, he used the spring, I think, in our analogy used, like, you can only push the spring back so far, and then it comes bursting out. And I think this is the delusion of escalation control. I think they believe that the Russians would just escalate in the same incrementalism. But when I think when the Russians come, they come in a big way. They say, okay, now we take back Crimea. Now we invade or go into Donbass. Okay, now we're going to annex four oblasts. When they come in a big way. So, but again, this is the delusion of escalation control, which is becomes a common theme if you look at all the last wars.
Yeah, there's a Russian saying, that they should learn. There's a lot of Russian sayings they should learn. But a very good one in this case is Russians are slow to get in the saddle, but once they're in, they gallop at a high pace. So yeah, that's a spring. We tolerate, 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 but then we go take somebody's head off because the tolerance. Those who tolerate the most are seek vengeance the worst. So
It's also a
that's.
common thing in Russia in wars, though. It's often in the beginning, one sees that they might stumble and adjust to the what's happening, and then they get organized, and then it's game over, essentially. And we've seen this many times.
I
So.
got two more questions. I know everybody's short on time. I got two more questions for you. One is from a practical point, economic practical point. The second one is a theological, I guess you may say, to the exceptionalism. And let's do theological first. Okay, so Russians out technologizing the entire EU. It's hard to swallow because we're the Eastern barbarian. But we're white, so they kind of look like them. So I guess philosophically, you could kind of try to explain that. And then you get these brown people, Iran, that now is showing that not only they're not just some third world jungle, as opposed to the garden that Borrelli described in the West, but they're also quite capable of outdistancing the West in technology. They're quite advanced. They're quite, it's an ancient civilization. How does that square with the exceptionalism that the West still clings on to? I mean, the European powers have always clung on to this, that they're carrying the white man's burden to the rest of humanity, where we have to civilize them and we have to bring them limited amounts of technology because we're better than them. We're sent to do this. And now you look at Iran that has, in a lot of categories, better technology than anything the US can come up with.
Well, I think it's painful adjustment, but one which had to come, and also one which people like Adam Smith, of all people, actually look forward to, because, well, first you know, some of this is about human nature. That is, human beings, they're a group animal. We tend to organize in groups, and it's very common to assess one's own identity by othering another group. That they have to
Right,
be your
right.
outgroup. So you have, us versus them. Us, who are we? Well, you can only identify, if you will, as white if there's a black, for example. Otherwise, it doesn't
Right,
make any
right.
sense. No one identifies as having two arms. It doesn't make sense unless you have a race of people with more, So you have, us and them. You have, East and West. You have civilians barbarians. Now we have the world is divided between liberal democracies and authoritarians. It's a good way of saying good guys, bad guys, superior, inferior. So this is a little bit in human nature. And Russia always played the Europeans outgroup because they were the east to our west. They were the Asians in Europe. They were the authoritarians to our democracy. So this is kind of how it the role that they also always had to play. And but I think all human beings do this. I think though that the Europeans and the West in general went far into the excess. And to understand why, you can go back to Adam Smith because he had some interesting paragraphs in his books where he wrote, the greatest discovery in the world, he said, were the discovery of America's and the East Indies, because this connected the whole world. But then he also went on saying, well, however, we also have to recognize all the peoples that the Europeans came in encounter with were destroyed. They suffered greatly. So, and he had to explain this because it's not just that Europeans are horrible people, but he said it's just that the economic development at this point in time, coming out of an industrial revolution, it had become too different. So the economic power was too much asymmetrical, and for this reason, all economic connectivity happened in a very exploitive way. So if you find someone who developed, and then you go around the world and you find all these people who are less developed, this superiority and dominance would then fuel some ideas and ideology about superiority. So, and that's what you saw. We have, but you also want to make your dominance seem virtuous. So we have a white man's burden or a civilizing mission. So we're going to dominate you, but it's going to be for your own good. We still did that after the 90s, though. You say, well, we have a responsibility to protect them, not a right, but a responsibility. It's our goal, our moral duty to go in the world and assist countries with democracy, human rights. And if they don't fall in line, it's because of a bad leader, and we just remove him. So, power becomes concealed in this kind of ideology. Anyways, my point was, I think this has all historically fueled the superiority idea. So now that you have, Iranians fighting back and winning, you have Russians fighting back and winning. It's not how it was supposed to be. However, if you go back to Adam Smith, just to hammer on about him, he did make the point that ideally you want a world where there's better symmetry, because if you have two big differences, it's going to be very exploitative. So he said, ideally in the future, either the Europeans will be a little bit weaker or the rest of the world a bit stronger, because then the relationships would be more equal, it would be less exploitative, less aggressive. And I would say for that same reason, it would be less defined by superiority and inferiority. And he said this is something we have to adjust to and in the future. And I think we are there now, and we should adjust to this. It would be better for the world, but also better for us. This tears away at the soul of a nation if you go
Oh, yes.
around viewing, fellow human beings as being inferior.
Absolutely. Okay, so final question, and this goes to
Sorry, that
the
was a very long
economic.
answer.
No, it's a great answer. It's a very good answer. The final question is going into the economic sphere, is has Europe considered the threat of actual starvation in Europe by the second half of this year? The reason I'm saying is, in modern agriculture, the only reason we're able to really feed humanity at the level we're able to feed is the Green Revolution, which started in the 1950s. It was both a biological revolution, getting new varieties of crops and that are better adjusted, but also because we went into chemical fertilizers. Now, Russia's 40% of the world's chemical fertilizer, and urea being a major portion of the of it, ammonia base coming out of the gas, natural gas. Qatar was basically 30% was because it's no longer working, period, until some time in the future when they're able to go up. So Europe would cut itself off from Russian fertilizer. Actually, part of the sanctions package was no more Russian fertilizer, which by the way, Americans last year bought $500 million worth of Russian fertilizer, and this year might be heading up to $1 billion. What is Europe going to do? It can't produce its own. Gas is too expensive. They've closed those plants down back in the 19, I mean, I'm sorry, 19, in the 2018, 2021 range. Most of them were closed down. What are they going to do now? Or have they even thought about it? It's planting season in Southern Europe. It'll be planting season in Northern Europe in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
No, it's well, that's part of the problem, and this was one of the things they went after, not just against the Russians, but against the Belarusians. That is, liberating themselves from their fertilizers as well, which creates some big problems for the agriculture. And no, it's not a big discussion, but again, the assumption was that one can have this conflict with Russia, but all the other variables will remain constant. That is, we can still have access to, the Middle East, all these things. But as things unravel, the whole world becomes to be become destabilized. So it's not no. It just a lot of this should have been predictable, but now that it's actually happening, you would think that there would be, something just decided. Well, let's put, for example, an end to this war with Russia and try to normalize relations. And indeed, some politicians are saying that. As I said, even the Finnish president made this point that perhaps we should have some diplomacy with Russia. So they're realizing, I think, the disaster we're heading towards. But it's kind of what you have to say, behind the closed doors, because, in the public realm, everyone committed themselves to the same narratives. That is, Putin is the new Hitler, and Russia, once they're done with Ukraine, they were going to take Poland and march on Paris. I mean, all these things, they're just imperialists, they're going to dominate everything. Everyone bought into this, which limits the possibility to make any compromises. And what can you do in the Middle East? They can they don't really want to they Don't really want to condemn the Americans and Israelis, but they feel comfortable condemning Iran for retaliating. And no, so
Hypocrisy.
it's yeah, no, I think it's two big changes that happens at a time to Europe, which is organized around the idea that we have to have mass consensus on everything. There's a massive narrative control. Otherwise, these 27 countries might start drifting in different directions. So it's not a great block to adjust to new realities. I think it was the former Italian prime minister. I had the pleasure of meeting him once, actually. He once made a speech where he said that the EU was a bit like a giant made out of clay. It's big, it's impressive, but if it tries to move around too much, it falls apart. And that's because it consists of many independent states. Romano Prodi, sorry, that's his name. I got. Yeah. Anyways, and he and I like that analogy because that is correct. It could be powerful and influential if it doesn't move too much. The problem is we're now in a very massive. The world is changing very quickly. The Europeans have to adjust to new realities, and their whole unity now is to a large extent organized around the need to balance Russia. If you take that away from them, what is left? So. It's I think at least that's how I see it. I think this is the heart of the problem, why they can't adjust to these realities, which will, come and crush them very soon.
As the Chinese curse goes, may you live in interesting times. I actually had to explain that to work that to my fellow employees in Canberra and other places that dealt with the Chinese. Like, that's not a good thing.
No.
That's not, oh, they're really cool. They hope we lived in interesting. They just cursed you. What? That's not a good thing. Which goes back to understanding other cultures and what people are saying to you. Glenn, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. I know everybody's busy. I'm sorry about the time change. Again, we had internet down. Part of a new norm. When drones fly, they shut down the internet because the damn things feed off the internet to get their coordinates. So it's off and on. But maps. There was a small news article 2 days ago that the sale of paper maps has skyrocketed. So that, everybody's gonna go back to reading a piece of paper once in a while. But that's where we're at. Glenn, thank you very much for joining. Where can people find you?
Well, I have my own YouTube channel. It's just my name, Glenn Deason. I should have probably come up with a name for it.
That's a good
Also,
name.
I'm also on Twitter and Substack. So, the Substack is a combination of those videos, but also articles I write. So.
Yeah, I'm using Substack also for backup. I've got some articles, but mostly it's videos I'm putting on there just in case YouTube decides to, be
Yeah, you never know.
YouTube. And you never know. You never know. That's the truth. Everybody, thank you very much for joining. Glenn, thank you once more. And we'll see you on the next one. Leave some comments, and I'll make sure Glenn has the link. So, thank you, everyone. Cheers.